Thank you all for coming to our concluding presentation. You're excited they're over. Okay. You've had enough? You got the writing figured out now? Oh, okay. Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. That's not going to affect your grade, by the way. It's not going to help. But I appreciate it. It's better than Stephen's going to heckle me, he said, during the presentation. So I prefer that. I'm very lucky to be concluding our group of talks. And I actually want to refer in my opening to Charles Caleb Colton. He's an English cleric in the late 18th century. And he is credited with saying that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. Dr. Roper, in his book, The Writer's Workshop, another book that I would encourage you to look into, takes another approach to imitation. He says that imitation of the great is a way to learn an art and develop into an accomplished artist oneself. As teaching is the art that I'm developing, please bear with me as I imitate a few of the greats here at UD over the next 40 minutes. I'd like to begin by imitating Dr. Moran, as he encouraged us to open with a quotation and to try not to bore the audience. So hopefully Derek's enthusiasm will remain throughout this talk. I'd also like to imitate Dr. Waterman Ward as I make use of logical operators or conjunctions in my thesis statement that I present to you and in the transitions between the topic sentences I give you. I'd also like to imitate Dr. Cowan as my discoveries in the essay I am prepared to submit to you came out both of writing and of class discussions in which I will be imitating my students who provided the ideas for the talk I'm giving today, as they talked about, as they discussed Paradise Lost over the last few weeks. I'd also like to imitate Dr. Romanick Baldwin as I establish the problem of Adam and Eve's apparent separation before the fall in the introduction to my talk. I'll also imitate Mrs. Cohen, as I know that we don't have time for me to give you complete paragraphs with supporting evidence and let you leave before 7 o'clock tonight. So instead, what I've done is I've condensed the paragraphs that I will support in the future, next Tuesday in my classes, with textual evidence. I've condensed those paragraphs into topic sentences. And I'd like to attempt to imitate Mrs. Niebuhr. This is actually the most difficult for me because I tried to fit so much into my topic sentences that I don't have as much sentence variety as I would like to have in the presentation that I'm giving you today. But I will do my best to imitate her when possible. And of course, I would like to imitate Dr. Kreider, who's come here today. As I apply the terms, this is now the fourth time that we've had a presenter mention this book. It might be a nice hint to all of you to look into the bookstore and get this Office of Assertion, right? But I hope to apply the terms that he presents in his Office of Assertion as I give examples of my own conclusions for the paper that I write to you. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to present an introduction and the topic sentences of body paragraphs for a complete paper. Then I'm going to give you a number of possible conclusions, right? And those conclusions are all examples that are, again, or many of which are based on the terms that Dr. Kreider uses in his book. Right? And I hope to talk through some of these examples to say when a particular kind of conclusion might be appropriate for a particular paper. Okay, but they're all based on this essay I'm about to present to you. So here I begin with Dr. Moran's advice. Upon discovering that an individual working in the field before him had taken joy in and spared a tuft of flowers, the speaker of Robert Frost's poem imagines himself telling that kindred spirit that men work together, whether they work together or apart. Whether he knows it or not, this speaker presents a helpful insight into the relationship between Adam and Eve in Milton's Paradise Lost, insofar as, soon after eating of the fruit, both believe they had been working independently of one another before the fall. This belief leads Adam to blame Eve for their trespass against God. "Would thou hadst hearkened to my words and stayed with me as I besought thee when that strange desire of wandering this unhappy morn, I know not whence, possessed thee. We had then remained still happy, not as now despoiled of all our good, shamed, naked, miserable." Adam's diatribe includes an attempt to establish his own innocence in the fall, as he claims that he was ignorant of Eve's intention to leave his side insofar as hers was a strange desire of wandering, and as he claims to know not whence she was headed. Eve, for her part, recognizes the problems within Adam's claims to both innocence and ignorance as she challenges his belief that she and he were never meant to part from one another. "Was I to have never parted from thy side, as could have grown there a lifeless rib? Being as I am, why didst not thou, the head, command me absolutely not to go, going into such danger as thou saidst? Too facile then thou didst not much gainsay, nay didst permit, approve, and fair dismiss. Hadst thou been firm and fixed in thy descent, neither had I transgressed, nor thou with me." With Eve's claim that Adam deserves more blame in their sin insofar as he failed as her head, we now have a nice summary from the mouths of Milton's own protagonists of the very arguments readers of Paradise Lost tend to make as they place blame for the fall on either Adam or Eve. What I find most interesting in this exchange, however, is not the blame that the first parents pin on one another, but the focus both place on the separation that led to their fall. Indeed, both of their arguments turn on this term, as Adam says Eve should have stayed with him, and Eve wonders how she could be anything more than a lifeless rib if never allowed to part from Adam's side. Although both Adam and Eve identify the cause of their fall in their separation from one another, a closer examination of their previous experiences apart from one another reveals that even when physically separated from one another, Adam and Eve remained together as kindred spirits. Now I want to present, so I've given you my thesis statement, my introduction where we have the problem, and now I want to just give you the topic sentences that I would develop given time with textual evidence. Okay, I'm going to begin in book 4. Although one could claim that Adam and Eve are separate from one another from the moment of Eve's creation insofar as Eve takes more pleasure in her own image than she does in Adam's presence, she must be convinced to walk towards him by a warning voice, and she only yields to his companionship after his gentle hand seized hers. Eve does demonstrate that she and Adam are kindred spirits when, immediately upon waking from creation, the very first question she poses, a question that Adam does not hear her pose, is the question that Adam answers when they first meet. Point 2 from book 8. If Eve's waking wonder testifies to the kindred spirit shared by Adam and Eve, so too does Adam's waking recognition that he cannot know himself without Eve's mutual society. So both Adam and Eve, created separate from one another, even at the moment of their creation, recognize that they are kindred spirits. Support 3 from Book 8 again, earlier in Book 8 actually. Because that support number 2 actually came from a discussion that Adam gave to Raphael with Eve not being present for the discussion. You think, gosh, Adam, just tell that to Eve, you know, everything's fine, right? But here we have Eve is separate for that discussion of Adam's discussion and of his own waking. So while readers are quick to identify a separation between Adam and Eve because Eve does not hear this conversation between Adam and Raphael, such readers miss that even as Eve leaves to tend her garden, because she wants to hear from Adam's own lips what he discusses with Raphael, the narrator praises Adam and Eve as kindred spirits who are unique among mankind insofar as, even at this parting, they are in love and mutual honor joined. The next point from Book 5, going back in the text. Just as Eve's absence from Adam's side during his discussion with Raphael does not equal Eve's separation from Adam, Eve's solitary dream is not evidence that she and Adam have lost their kindred understanding. On the contrary, the two prove to be intimately connected before, during, and after this dream, insofar as Eve divulges to Adam the dream, a dream in which she sought him. Adam recognizes that her dream might have been born out of their shared conversations, and Adam displays empathy for her troubled condition after the dream. He feels the same trouble that she feels from this dream. Jumping ahead now to Book 9. This kindred spirit that pervades what I would go so far as to call a shared dream by the time Eve relates it to Adam is also present as Adam and Eve discuss whether or not Eve should leave Adam's side. The two only end this conversation, which spans about 200 lines of poetry, after they have clearly understood one another and Adam has commanded Eve to go. Eve merely obeys. While Eve's obedience to Adam underscores the clarity with which Adam and Eve hear one another, right? The obedience actually has to do with, that term actually has to do with what you hear, as opposed to submit, which just means you're placed under, you're put under. They're actually two very different terms. So while Eve's obedience to Adam underscores the clarity with which Adam and Eve hear one another when at one another's side, her use of first-person plural pronouns throughout her interactions with Satan up until the moment she eats the fruit highlights her understanding that she and Adam remain kindred spirits even at what most consider to be the clearest and most critical instance of separation. Now, it's worth noting that I make this claim in the face of the narrator's own argument, repeated a number of times in just a few lines, that Eve is separate when Satan approaches her. I'm still going to make the argument. And why? It's an instance of colored narration at that time. It's actually Satan's thoughts are making their way into the narration at that moment, that with that focus on separation. It is also worth noting that while waiting for Eve's return, Adam's heart, divine of something ill, misgave him. Adam knows the temptation Eve faces even as he crafts her crown. So there we have my thesis statement, and my body paragraphs condensed into topic sentences. Right? Now what I want to do is I actually want to give you a few possible conclusions that you could use if you were the one writing this essay. Right? And I wanted to discuss a little bit the times when you would use these different conclusions and the point of using these different conclusions. And again, in this discussion of different kinds of conclusions, I want to rely heavily on Dr. Kreider's book, especially what I find to be a very helpful statement that he makes in his Office of Assertion when he says that the pleasure of endings is caused by our desire for completion. So we want to actually feel as if we have some sense of completion when we turn our essays into our professors, right? So there are four different types of conclusions that Dr. Kreider discusses. One is summaries, right, where you just summarize what you've said, right, and these should be accurate and complete. Let me give you an example of a summary of my talk here. That Adam and Eve remain kindred spirits, this is number one, I believe, on your sheet. That Adam and Eve remain kindred spirits from the moment of their creation until the moment of their fall is clear from Eve's waking question and Adam's matching response, from Adam's waking recognition of his need for Eve's mutual society, from Eve's desire to tend her garden and her preference for Adam's language even over the tongue of angels, from Adam and Eve's shared dream, from their shared understanding prior to Eve's final pre-fall departure, and from Eve's repeated reference to Adam throughout her exchange with Satan. So there we have a summary conclusion, and if you've had me in class, you've heard me say, don't do that, right? You've heard me say, don't do that because you've given me 2 to 3 page papers, and you've given me a clear thesis statement, and you've had clear transitions between paragraphs, and I know what your paragraphs are about, and so I don't need, after 2 pages of reading, or a page and a half, to have you give it to me again, right? My memory is bad, but it's not that bad, okay? So that's why you hear probably from me over and over again, and you get marks on your essay that say, don't give me this. Give me something more, right? So this kind of conclusion might be helpful for somebody giving a talk to a group of students, and the students do not have the paper in front of them, right? You have to talk. The student has to listen for 20 minutes or half an hour to the person up front babbling away, and they might lose what's actually happened in the course of the talk. And so a conclusion of this kind might actually be helpful to remind people of where you've been. Right? I would say, however, even with this kind of conclusion, that I don't quite feel complete after I read that to you. I feel that there still is something missing. Right? I have reminded you of what I've said. Right, and in the case such as this, if you've written a 20-page paper, if you're given a long presentation, it's good to remind people of what you said. But I would say, don't ever stop there. Right. So the question is, how much of your body paragraphs or how much of your central argument do you need to include in your conclusion? Right. Here, I've got all of it. Right. So you might need to do that if it's a longer paper. But then do something more with it, right? And so I want to give you some examples of what you can do more with it, how you can maybe begin with a certain amount of summary and then add something more to leave that sense of completion. So here's another example. I believe it's number 2 on your sheet. Whereas Satan claims that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil transforms into gods those who eat of it, both Adam and Eve revert to a beast-like ignorance as a result of their gluttony. This ignorance becomes clear as their discourse after the fall turns on terms they no longer understand. As Adam equates physical separation to kindred understanding, and Eve equates physical proximity to submission. Fortunately, though Adam and Eve both fail to understand their own kindred nature immediately after their fall, their ignorance does not last. Instead, they seek out an education that challenges them to acknowledge their own parts in their fall, to seek forgiveness from one another and from God, and to join hands as they enter their new home. So what I have here is I have not a full summary, as I gave you in the last example, but all I have here to tell you that I've proven my point is my central point that they have a kindred understanding, right? So all I really use as far as repetition is that term kindred and a little bit of repetition of the terms that are central to the entire paper, right? So separation being central to the paper, and that kindred being central to the entire paper. And so there's not as much summary of the whole in this paper, but enough to tell you, I know what I've talked about, I know that you followed me, and I know that I can go on from what I've given you thus far. And this kind of conclusion specifically if I haven't corrupted Dr. Kreider's descriptions from the Office of Assertion, I want to label and express an opinion without proving it, right? This is where you express an opinion. You make a claim about the text, right? So the first half of this conclusion is where I actually show you that there's an ignorance involved after the fall. That actually, whereas Adam and Eve think that they're going to become like gods, they're going to, they actually have reverted. They've actually damaged their nature, right? And then the claim that I make is because I've proven that point, I hope, in the beginning, of, in the body of my talk, right? But the claim that I make is that ignorance does not last, right? So that actually I could continue this paper, right, and prove that point. I could prove to you that they don't remain ignorant, but at least that they're trying to solve that ignorance, right? Now there's a danger with this kind of conclusion as well. Right? And the danger is that rather than make a claim about the rest of the text, you just summarize the rest of the text. Right? So you have to actually claim something about the rest of the text. You can't just say Adam and Eve are ignorant before the fall and they walk off hand in hand at the end. Right? You actually have to have some sort of a claim. It's the same thing you do throughout your paper, right? Everything you state, even if you're given narrative detail, that narrative detail is attached to some greater claim that you're making. The same is true with your conclusion, right? We know how it ends. You don't have to tell us that, right? You have to make some claim about how it ends. The nice part about this kind of conclusion is you don't necessarily have to prove it, but you do have to show that your claim is connected to that latter claim. Okay? Any questions so far about those first two examples? No? Clear? Okay. Alright, great. Alright, let's give another one then. I got plenty. The news that Adam and Eve remain kindred spirits from the moment of their creation until the moment of their fall should challenge readers to reconsider the argument Milton might be making in displaying the unjust anger Adam and Eve direct at one another. We might even find in their display of hatred a request from Milton. A request that we be charitable towards his creations. After all, Paradise Lost is Milton's work of art, and the first parents within that book are his beloved children. So what I have here is an attempt to make an emotional appeal. And these are actually very difficult, the emotional appeals. They're difficult for a number of reasons. One, as Dr. Kreider points out, is that it actually has to be a sincere emotion, right? You actually have to feel that emotion as the writer. Right? You don't want to try and stir up fake emotions in your readers if you don't feel them yourself, right? That's unjust itself, right? So the emotion has to be a real emotion. You have to actually believe it, right? And you have to be careful that you don't just write a Hallmark card in your closing, right? We don't have, your readers aren't necessarily reading your piece because they want a free version of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, right? So you have to find some way to make the emotion real, because emotions are real, right? And they shouldn't be ignored in any writing, in academic writing. They are significant, but you have to be careful and just be sure that you're being true to the actual emotions that are you're trying to represent, right? And any questions about that, about the emotional appeal? Okay, let me give you another one. The danger with recognizing that Adam and Eve are together up until the moment of their fall is that we, as readers, will simply shift from blaming one or the other of them for our fallen state to blaming both of them, We get off easy, right? Aha, they both did it. To do so is to miss the ugliness Milton attaches to moments of blame within his work. In Milton's version of the fall, neither Adam nor Eve deserves blame for blaming the other. I'm sorry, deserves praise. Neither one deserves praise for blaming the other. Nor do we deserve praise for blaming them. Instead, as we come into being with them, take part in their conversations, and even fall alongside them, we should recognize that we share the same kindred spirit that they share. The benefit of this recognition is that rather than free falling into the pits of hell after any one trespass, we remain sufficient to stand. Here I actually have another emotional appeal, but this one's a little bit different, right? In the first emotional appeal, I feel that I focused more on how we approach Milton's character, and it has to do with how we approach our reading, right? Whereas the second one I actually have included in this argument that we really shouldn't be blaming anybody else for our fall, right? I maybe don't make it as explicit as I need to, so maybe this needs another draft. But by recognizing that we fall along with them, right? We learn how to read, we learn the correct way to approach characters in books, but we hopefully also think of how to approach other people in our lives, right? That this conclusion can very easily even be brought outside of the text more. But again, with trying to grab it, to tug at some emotions that people might feel. But not to play with people, right? Again, not to play with them, not to mess with them, but because it is the appropriate emotion for that topic. Okay. Let me give you one more. This is the tail-biting snake that Dr. Carter mentions. While Frost's speaker might not realize that he is providing an avenue into Milton's Adam and Eve when he addresses the kindred spirit with whom he worked, it does seem fair to presume that this speaker is considering the fall insofar as his thoughts begin in lonely despair before moving towards a shared wonder. After all, Frost's narrator is himself a gardener impressed with the leaping tongue of bloom the scythe had spared. He expresses an Adam-like desire to know these flowers by their name, and he seeks at noon the same shade that Adam and Eve sought, even in the garden. According to Frost's narrator, at least, we are not alone, we are not left alone after the fall, but remain sufficient to lean on one another in the work that we do and the dreams that we share. So here I actually went all the way back to my opening sentence. Right, that Dr. Moran mentioned this, that you can't just plop a quotation in your opening and then go on to something else, right? You actually have to show that there is some connection between your opening quotation and the rest of your paper, right? And you should show it right away, but it doesn't hurt to actually go back to that opening again in your closing to say, look, there was a reason to compare these two works, right? It's not only that Frost's language actually helps us to understand the fall, but maybe you can go back and see, oh, maybe this discussion of the fall helps us understand Frost's work. So there is some mutual work being done there between the texts, right? So that is the tale of biting a snake. And actually, I do have one more conclusion that is kind of a combination between Dr. Kreider's conclusion and one of my own, right? So you can actually combine these conclusions and start to, now that you've done the imitation work, start to see how you can craft your own style, right? So you can start with imitation. Why? So that you have those formula down that you can really use well, and then start to improve on those formula in your own way, right? But you have to have something to start with. Otherwise, you're just going to be lost from the get-go, right? If you don't know how to spin a wheel in pottery, you're not going to make very beautiful pots. Okay, you got to start somewhere. So here I want to give you my final closing conclusion. I claim that the goal in my imitation was flattery. But sincere or not, flattery does not quite get at my goal. Instead, throughout this talk, I hope I have expressed gratitude to those I have imitated, to those who have taught me both here at UD and at home, and to those of you who have attended or listened to these talks. Indeed, perhaps my greatest debt is to all of you, because without your presence, without your desire for completion, none of us would be able to enter into these great conversations that permeate our tradition, and few of us would stop to reflect on the discoveries that writing makes possible. Thank you. Thank you. Any questions? Yes. My point was that he's has a kind of a commentary on the dangers of blaming one another to begin with, and that that we need to be at least careful for pointing the finger too quickly. As you see, actually, this is one danger I had with actually presenting this presentation in this way, is I would end up in more of a defense of my paper than a discussion of conclusions. But the point I was trying to make was that as Adam and Eve start to turn towards God again, is they begin by pointing to themselves, right? And so it seems that throughout Paradise Lost, there seems to be an encouragement that you need to look to yourself first before you put the blame anywhere else. But yeah, thank you. Any questions about the conclusions themselves as conclusions? Because I'm going to defend my points again on Tuesday for most of you, and give more textual evidence. But what about conclusions as conclusions? Do you have any questions about any of that? Or are you thinking, woohoo, we got done early and the final's finally here? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. I gave you a little present. The back of that sheet has a Robert Frost poem. So, have a wonderful break.